I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Every third Wednesday of the month, except in the summer, since 2012, from noon to 1 p.m., a gathering occurs at the Tech Gallery at SFU's Harbour Centre campus here in downtown Vancouver. It's called Lunch Poems. People bring their lunches, their poetry, and they sit and listen to readings. It's one of those great undertakings that exemplifies just how rich a cultural life there is in this town, especially if you just look. A new collection of poems, The Revolving City, 51 poems and the stories behind them, features poetry that's evolved from Lunch Poems. These poets have all participated at these Wednesday events, and they contribute an essay, a reflection on the poem, its meaning, and its inspiration. The founders of Lunch Poems and the editors of this collection, Wade Compton and Renee Sarojini Saklakar, join me now to talk about this book, these poems, these poets, and this place they've created. Wade Compton is the acclaimed writer of two books of poetry, Performance Bond and the 49th Parallel Psalm, which was a finalist for the Dorothy Livesey Poetry Prize. He edited the anthology Blueprint, Black British Columbian Literature and Orature. His nonfiction book, After Canaan, Essays on Race, Writing, and Region, was shortlisted for the City of Vancouver Book Award, as has his first work of fiction, The Outer Harbor. He is the director of the Writers' Studio and the South Bank Writers' Program at Simon Fraser University Continuing Studies. Renee Sarojini Saklakar was last on in 2013 for her collection of poetry, Children of Air India, Unauthorized Exhibits and Interjections, which won the Canadian Authors Association Award for Poetry and was also a finalist for the Dorothy Livesey Prize. She is a mentor and instructor at SFU, and her website is at thecanadaproject.wordpress.com. Wade's website is at wadecompton.com. I'll also get Renee to talk about Air India Redacted, which will be presented the 6th through the 11th of November. This collection is published by Anvil Press. Please welcome to the Plant Online program Wade Compton and Renee Saklakar. Ms. Saklakar, good morning.
Good morning.
And Mr. Compton, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks both for coming in to do this. I appreciate it.
Well, it's a pleasure.
The idea for Lunch Poems, I guess that's where it all started, this book, that's where it began. Whose idea was it?
Well, it's a bit of a story because I was having dinner with a woman named Shauna Sylvester, who's one of our Lunch Poem team members and an amazing person. She's a director at SFU Public Square, right downtown at SFU Vancouver Harbor Center. And she and I were having dinner in 2011, I believe. And she asked me about poetry and what I was doing, and she talked about the fact that she read poetry, but wasn't necessarily, you know, reading a great deal. She would read a little bit at night or something. And she invited me to come down to SFU and do a little reading. It was quite impromptu, and it was in one of those little classrooms at SFU Vancouver, you know, no windows. But it was really lovely, and there were a few people there, and she got this idea in conversation with me. Well, why don't we try and enliven the public space downtown SFU Vancouver in the Tech Gallery with some poetry? And what about a poetry happening? And what about lunchtime so that it's not in the evening, but hopefully people around the neighborhood? And, you know, it's an interesting neighborhood with its own challenges and demarcations, if you will, down there. What if we tried to really make community happen through poetry at lunch? And we were very, very fortunate that I think just as we were having this discussion, you were appointed director of the Writer's Studio, I think.
Yeah, it was right around that time.
Yeah, and how lucky were we that Wade would be part of our team. And I think maybe you can talk a little bit of how we evolved originally from our inaugural reading with, it was Daniela Elza and the then Poet Laureate, Evelyn Lau. Mm-hmm. And then As we went on, Wade became much more a curator of pairings. Did you want to?
Yeah, we started out with, we asked Evelyn to pick someone. So I like the idea of having a more established poet choose an emerging poet to come and read with them. That's what we did for the first little bit. And then we sort of dropped that. Just had pairings that were interesting. Of our own.
You realize just looking at the list of the people in this book just how rich a poetry scene there is, because there's so many poets here. I mean, some people also come from out of town, I understand, to read for you guys. But the Tech Gallery, that's when you're on Hastings, I guess, and you enter the building, that's straight ahead, right? Mm-hmm. That's the big window.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, the light is quite beautiful for now until development takes it away. The view of the harbor is, poets often remark on it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so the sort of people that come in there, I mean, are those people from the neighborhood, as Renee said, those are business people, those are people in the downtown east side as well, Gastown, they all congregate there as well?
I think it's mostly poetry people, but what's different about it is because it's in the daytime, you know, readings and launches are usually at night,
mm-hmm.
and occasionally on a weekend day, but not during the weekday. So it's people who are working downtown often who are able to kind of step out of work for an hour and come down to the reading and then go back. And for me, you know, I'm one of those people now who doesn't go out for readings as much in the evenings anymore. Mm-hmm. So I think it's great. So you get it. I think we see a different demographic of people who are able to catch a poetry reading that they might not otherwise have been able to go to.
And the other thing is, you don't have to be, say, a poet or someone who reads poetry a great deal to enjoy these hours on Wednesday, right?
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, we have fans of poetry, not necessarily poets, but poets, students, and then people who come in for specific readers, right? Who
are yeah.
Very
interested
much.
In that specific yeah. poet. Yeah,
and so it happens once a month, mm-hmm. 10 months of the year. And so did you find it must not be difficult to find poets to want to come down, or is it?
It's more about getting the pairing for me and getting two who work interestingly together, because that's fun when you get a couple different poets that sort of ping off of each other in different ways, right?
Yeah.
You sort of see the other. I don't know, the one thing about me, I mean, I've always felt like... interested in poetry from all different positions. I think for whatever reason, poetry is a really kind of fiercely encamped kind of form. You know, really
even when we go around denying that we're encamped.
Oh yeah, but the camps are there. They're very different types of poetry, and you know, people often adhere to one or the other. But I think there's interesting stuff happening in all the different positions. So it's been. I like to use the word ecumenical.
Yeah, and because there is a poem in here, the big circle. The words are all around in a circle. Your piece on Hogan's Alley reads like a news article. Renee's work, has these various line breaks and the sort. When you think about poetry, it can be daunting. It can worry a lot of people. I mean, I'm someone who grew up with it in school and who didn't particularly enjoy it. And as I get older, I'm reading a lot more just because I'm talking to the poets. But I'm finding it... I'm finding that I'm learning more about it now at my own pace. And so I'm wondering, I mean, you're both educators, you're both instructors. Do you think it's being taught differently and perhaps not as engaged as it should be for students?
Well, as a student of Wade's, I would like to just share my gratitude online for the way that the Writer's Studio, of which I'm a grad, approaches the writing life, writing practice, poetry, text. There's a sort of studio method, and I'm interested what Wade will say about that, but as someone who's now, and I'm delighted to, invited back, as we were talking about, to come and share with students, I think it's about meeting people where they're at and trying to open up what poetry is. And so Wade's word ecumenical, I think, becomes quite important. My experience of being taught poetry when I was growing up was very rigid, and it was sort of this idea that the work of the poet emerged perfectly formed onto the page, and that had a very distancing effect. Whereas what I think we've tried to do in this book, and the way I have experienced being taught writing from people like Wade, is the sense of what is the process of writing, and I don't know if you wanted to.
Yeah, well, I think Renee's work is a really good example of what poetry can do and what it's for and how it works today. I think because Renee was in my nonfiction group, and as I point out, most of my nonfiction people who went on to publish things other than nonfiction. I've got a few nonfiction people, but a lot of them published, you know, fiction. You know, short fiction, novels, and then Renee poetry. But I mean, it makes perfect sense because when you're working on your project, I think what was coming out were questions around language, and so you were moving more. You know, well, you came in writing poetry as well, but poetry seemed to make the most sense, I think, for you and how you were thinking. And that's what I think poetry does, is it's a place to consider language at its kind of smallest units and in a lot of ways in its most self-conscious way. And so when there are issues that are language issues, you know, and well, everything is really, but if that's, you know, if you want to focus on how things are represented and understood, poetry is a great place to do that.
Yeah.
And in the consumption of poetry, because we've talked about the space already that you guys inhabit, does it matter to you as a poet? I mean, you're both poets as well. How your writing is consumed?
What a fascinating question.
Mm-hmm. Because Wade just talked about you can see language at its purest, at its most basic, if you will. So it's a much more reflective time, I think, to read poetry than say the front page of a newspaper. So that would say to me that a person who reads poetry would spend a lot more time looking at the words that are on the page. So for you as readers and as writers, how do you look at the process of how the work is consumed?
Well, it's very interesting. The word consume, of course, makes me a little nervous, and it makes me think of a product. Mm. I do think that we are in times that make art into product, and I'm much more a process person, I think. No, it doesn't worry me. In fact, what I find fascinating about opening myself up to the types of writing that speak to me, certainly Wade's and many others that have come through and are part of the Writer Studio community, is that it's about language, it's about what language is and isn't, and it's about what's happening right now, as temporal as the front page. And everything can be kind of constructed and deconstructed. And one of the things that Wade really got me thinking about was, how do we represent all the things that are happening right now in our world and our life? How do we represent that on the page? What is the page? And here I was really lucky to have Wade, Rachel Rose, Betsy Warland. They were my first real teachers, along with people like David Ziroth at Douglas College and Calvin Wharton. And so a real range of what is language and how are we going to represent it? And yeah, this idea of representation I really learned from you and from Anne, Wade's partner. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something, you know, people talk about poetry and accessibility and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But then it's funny because in times of kind of great gravity, when people are at their most challenged in life or at landmarks and things like that, people do kind of naturally turn to poetry. And so there's something about language as ritual and language as challenge and language as a space to think in new ways or sort of see things anew, right? That we still seem to be ready to look at poetry. Mm-hmm. Now, as a consumer product, and, you know, of course, poetry is one of the genres that's least read. That's true. But, you know, that's because it's a challenge. And I think, you know, I don't think it necessarily has to sell. I don't think that's what it's for. You know, it's there for, it's like listening to free jazz or something like that. You know, it's something that when you listen to it, you actively listen to it, right? It's the same with poetry. When you read it, you have to actively read it. And so it's there for those moments that you're ready to do that.
So we have to come to it then. I mean because what turns off a lot of students in terms of having to read it at school is that there are expectations on them when they have to read it. There's a deadline time-wise, and then there's a, you know, the mark that you have to get, if you get it or not. As instructors, do you find that poetry could be taught better?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I was one of those weird kids that liked poetry in school, so I was fine with it.
Yeah.
I mean, but also, I mean, people love their song lyrics, you know?
Mm.
And
so
kids,
what is,
you know,
poetry?
Yeah, and kids write down song lyrics and obsess over them and think about them and memorize them and all of that. And it's not a big leap from one to the other, really.
Or advertising jingles. I mean, there's a dark shadow side to all of that. But poetry happens in a lot of different ways and places. Mm-hmm. Again, I have a high respect for teachers, particularly obviously in the public school system, but everywhere. And I don't want to be sounding like, well, I know how to teach poetry, because it's always a discovery and it's not so much teaching. It's about being open. For me, what I have learned and am learning from students is focus a little less on meaning. I think sometimes what happens in the classroom, if I remember it, was that we get so bogged down in what does this mean? And instead get playful about, hey, how does this word feel in your mouth when you say it? What about the materiality of language? Just language as sound, and then engaging the senses. Wade does this really neat module about, you know, writing from the five senses. And so you start to engage the body with what the breath and sound and movement is doing with words. And then it becomes fun. We talked about having Daniel Zamparelli in this book, and I understand, you know, he might be on this show in a
next
little
week,
while.
Yeah,
yeah, next week. And he and Dina Delbucchia, they just embody this. So there's a joie de vivre. Also, I find, I'm very interested in what Wade would say to this. I feel there is a distaste among certain houses of poetry writers for the provisional, whereas I think the provisional, that is maybe poetry that's, you know, fresh and in draft form and not perfect, it can be very liberating to just play with language, which isn't to say there shouldn't be rigor and that you don't spend time and the importance of skilled craft personship. But I also like provisional, and we have a wonderful poet in our book, Ray Sue, who does some very edgy things that I think some poets go, well, that's not poetry, right? But I don't know. What's your response?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the space that we reserve for thinking, you know, thinking directly about language. Where else do we do that, really? There's really no other form. I mean, fiction is not necessarily where people do that. It's storytelling. And nonfiction is, you know, the life or the experience is foregrounded most of the time. But poetry is a space where the language is foregrounded, you know, and sort of how you can think about life through, you know, all the way from really sort of traditional lyric poetry or form poetry from the past or something, all the way up to conceptual poetry and things that are doing something that's just challenging the very idea of what is form or what is poetry. All of it has in common that it's stepping outside of pure representation, you know, and looking at how we think and how we know things and how we know that through language.
So was it important for you then in putting this collection together to get not only the poem, but the essay that the poet contributes at the end, and not necessarily an essay, but the reflection, if you will, that they make about the poem, its genesis, what it's about? Because sometimes when you talk to poets, or like you wouldn't ask Don McLean what American Pie was about, because he'll probably tell you it's just a bunch of words, right? So was that important for you to have to get the poets themselves to spend the time to think about what they just wrote?
Well, I think the best thing we did, and it was kind of by accident, was not to define the genre of the reflection too hard, mm-hmm. because what we ended up getting were a bunch of different ways of approaching that question. And so I think there was some confusion about what is this reflection? What am I writing here? And so there were some people that sort of challenged the very notion, but even they often did something interesting with it. But so everybody kind of approached that differently. How do I write about my own poem? Everybody approached that task differently. And so I think we have a really neat array of responses. And that itself says something about how these poets think of their work. You know?
Absolutely. I think Wade here showed, as my co-editor, such discerning skill, as he always does. Because if we had defined what this thing was that would appear behind the poem, I think the poets would have run for the hills. And indeed, as Wade has said, we had a collection of poets that really resisted the idea, exactly as you're saying, of what or how they should do it. And I think what I loved about our approach was we were open. We were ecumenical to whatever they had to share. It was what they were going to share. I was inspired in the idea or vision I had for these, I think, ultimately quite intimate reflections by something I was asked to do by a wonderful online resource, 49th Shelf. And I was asked to write a reflection on a poem in Children of Air India for 49 Shelf, and they have a series called Behind the Poem, I think. And that was sort of in my mind as Wade and I were, you know, sitting with the stacks of books thinking about how to put this book together and what it might evoke. And we can talk a bit about that, you know, in this sort of loosely, this idea of theme. But that was sort of a model in my mind. But I think we took it to a slightly different place. And here I think Wade's gentle but very discerning hand was really important, because I think some of our poets were, they did not want to do it, right?
Oh, so some did refuse to, because some also come across as snippy, and they just...
Right, yeah. I mean, I think it's not, you're not asked to do it as a poet in the way that visual artists are. Mm-hmm. Visual artists are always asked to develop an artist statement along with their work, and that's become professionalized mm-hmm. in a certain way. And so there's an expectation to do that.
Comes the brand sometimes.
Right, but poets don't really get asked to do that, and then but what we do get asked is, what does it mean? Is just what you're saying, right? Is the, you know, people sort of having a panicked kind of feeling about, I don't understand this. And I think that's what was the kind of danger, is, you know, I don't want to explain my work kind of thing. But that we weren't asking them to necessarily explain it, just reflect upon it in whatever form that was. And for many it was theoretical, and for some it was autobiographical, and there were just a variety of different ways of thinking. For some it was another poem, you know?
Yeah. They're so beautifully written, these reflections, aren't they?
They are.
And they're so thoughtful. And Wade and I were talking that there's something very intimate about them. It's like reading a letter the poet is writing to themselves. You know, I find them so beautiful. They kind of take my breath away. And to have 51 is, again, a testament to this reading series, and really a shout out to how it has evolved with Wade's kind of curating these pairings. I think there's something deeply intuitive based on his skill as a writer that happens, you know, in that. And that, I think, enriches how this collection came to be.
Now, you're an established writer already, Wade. I've read the titles of your previous work. Did you get students writing you, high school students especially, asking you what an essay meant or a poem meant sometimes?
I did, yeah, I did for a while, and then I took my email address off my website because I was getting people asking. Sometimes it's very interesting, but I was getting that a little bit. Which is interesting, though, to hear about people, where they're studying. I'm always curious about that.
Yeah.
I have had a few people teach some of my poems in high school, which is neat. Because I have one poem that's references Ozymandias, and maybe that's one poem people remember learning in high school. And so I thought, oh, that's interesting. Somebody in high school is reading my response to Ozymandias alongside Shelley's poem, too. But then I put my email address back up because I was kind of missing them.
Yeah. And so what I found really great about having these pieces after the poems is that it's a side of the poet that we don't have to email for anymore. We can just,
right,
you know, it's
yeah.
right there.
That's right.
I mean, that's what I was thinking about when I was reading the book, just thinking back to old high school days. I mean, if I had to write an essay about a poem in this book,
yeah,
I would think, well, why don't I try to get a hold of the person and ask them what they thought? I mean, I used to do that in high school. I mean, I'd be writing a thing about politics, and I'd email Rafe Mayer about something, and then... Mm-hmm. So now I don't, because it's in this book. I have their unvarnished, sometimes their blunt
yeah.
reflection on what this poem meant to them. When you put a collection together like this, by the way, are the poems what they actually read at lunch poems?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
Yeah, not necessarily. This was, I thought, the fun part for us, where as editors you get to choose.
Mm-hmm.
So we were inspired by this idea of the city and what it's like to live in cities and everything that involves on so many levels, historical, cultural, linguistic, personal, individual. And what I really like about the book on so many levels is just its beautiful construction. Shout out to Anvil Press and SFU Public Square. It is a beautiful book, easy to carry. Some anthologies are a bit unwieldy and big. We've got 51, poems, and most of them are a page, a poem, sometimes a little longer, and then the reflections, maybe at most up to 2 pages. I think they're all one page. Mm-hmm. And you can slip it in your book and slip it in your bag and head out onto transit or, you know, wherever you're going. And I really like that. I like the whole thing together. And we've got this very interesting cover. I don't know if Wade wanted to talk
about it. Mary Iverson is the artist. And I love it because it looks like a kind of stylized and weird version of looking out the window of the Tech Gallery. You see sort of what look like containers and the mountains there. But she's from Washington State, Pacific Northwest visual artist, who seems very interested in containers, ships, container ships, and landscape. And it just feels so very Vancouver.
Yeah.
So is there a theme that emerges in this collection? I mean, you, Renee has alluded to sort of a loose theme. When you're putting this together, did you want to say something about this time, this place?
Well, the city is what emerged, right? I think because the series is downtown, so we were thinking of it as being centered there, and just we noticed that a lot. But we had a kind of, you know, people approached the idea of the city, and it came out of a public square event called Alone Together, too, and we're thinking about that different. You know, when you talk about being in the city or being urban people, that's both a singular experience and a collective. And all of these poems seem to look at that in one way or the other, or some blend of the two.
Mm-hmm, definitely. It becomes a kind of meditation on what it means to be alive right now in an urban, non-urban setting, you know, because as soon as you think of city, if you think of a demarcation or zones of demarcation, you think what's inside and what's outside. And one of the great joys I had was writing our own little essays, Wade and I, to introduce the book. So it became something that, you know, you start to think a bit deeper. And again, the other writers helping me to see where I live. It became kind of a profound experience for me, actually.
And history is so much a part of what we are today, isn't it? I mean, both of your pieces talk about aspects of our past. Do you find that people aren't as people are reflective about what's around them today, but as to what happened before, we could do a lot more, couldn't we, in terms of remembering?
Well, next week, the city council here in Vancouver is going to vote on whether or not to take down the Georgia and Dunsmuir viaducts, and I'm planning to be there to speak to that, because those viaducts are, for me and those of us in the Black community, are a kind of daily reminder of the policy of urban renewal and, you know, the authoritarian planning structure that basically sacrificed Vancouver's Black community, you know, for these large planning schemes, right? But that's a case of that sort of situation where, the viaducts are there as a reminder if you know that information. And so I've spent a lot of the last 15 years or more trying to make sure people know about the history of that community and just reminding them that there was a Black community in the city. But now this is an opportunity, I think, for if we take these viaducts down, to erect something that also kind of signals the memory of what was there.
Yeah. And I guess by all objective accounts, it will. These things will come down, won't they?
They're voting on it.
Yeah. Do you have a sense of where that'll be or how that'll go?
I don't know. I think that. Yeah, I think they want to. But yeah, we'll see how it goes. But I'm going to be there just to bear witness to. You know, either way, if they stay or if they go, you know, our community has a claim to that. I was thinking this today. This morning, I woke up thinking about this, that, you know, people, the perennial question about Vancouver's Black community is, where is it, right? And, mm-hmm. you know, Black people show up in the city from other places. That's the first thing they say, where's the Black community? And in a way, you can say the Black community is there, in that viaduct, mm-hmm. right? It's there. That's what happened to us.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the reason why we're all over the place and you can't find us, is because that was put there on top of our old community. And so, so taking it down is it's a weird thing. I'm sort of ambivalent about it because it's, you know, it's like, how do you treat a scar? You know, you don't, you know, in a way it's a marker of a wound, but it's also a memory of something that happened. And, You know, so there are all sorts of feelings about that. But
mm-hmm. It's so amazing to hear you speak it this way, because I think it becomes a kind of symbol. There are many in this book for the layering that occurs in any place.
Yeah.
But we very much rooted this collection for Vancouver or the city as an entity anywhere. And this idea of what gets layered into a city. So what is spoken? What is unspoken? What is remembered? What is forgotten? And this beautiful phrase Wade shared about, well, where are we? This is what happened, right? So this phrase, this is what happened, I think becomes a very powerful one for poetic inquiry. You know, what, where are people? And if they're not there, why are they not seen?
And this leads well into the way Renee and I connect as poets of memorial in some ways. And Renee's work is also something that deals with one of those wounds, right, in our national and international experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so her work on the Air India tragedy is really interesting that way, too, in that it's recalling this thing that people want to remember and don't want to remember at the same time. Those ambivalences about those... Mm-hmm. About those memories that must be maintained.
Yeah. And using poetry to get into that.
Yeah, and how we remember, I mean, varies from person to person. And so how we remember as a community, that's why we have votes. That's why we have discussions in the spaces that we create, because we need to find a way of knowing how to discuss these things or how to remember.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. You know, it comes up a lot in the poets we have in the book, you know. Both on a very individual, but mm-hmm. also on this collective way. So you see such a range in the book. Again, I think tied to the way Wade and Lunch Poems has envisioned what poetry is.
Has writing poetry for you, Wade, has that changed how you write prose?
Yeah, I mean, I think writing the stories, the only model I had for writing a book of short stories was writing books of poetry. And so uh-huh. I sort of approached the stories in the same way, as kind of building by accretion and association. Even though they're little bits of narrative, there's a kind of meta narrative, I guess, that's happening behind it all, that's more about association rather than a direct line of storytelling. And so that's where I think it came in. I think my prose voice, though, is very... syntactical. It's not the same as my verse voice for some reason. I don't know why, but
the voices of Wade Compton.
Yeah.
So when you are sitting down to write, you do have to go into a different place when you're writing, say, poetry.
Mm-hmm. Literally, I mean, yeah. I write different forms in different spaces. You know, I can write. I found I can write nonfiction in cafes with people talking and music on. But I can only write poetry in complete silence, usually at home, or maybe at the library. And then fiction is somewhere in between, where I can sort of, I like to be around people, but not, I don't really want them speaking.
Renee, did you always write poetry, even like as a kid?
I guess I did, but I had no real consciousness of being a writer. I had no models for what people do when they're writing in terms of writing practice. My parents were educated, immigrant parents, like many of us here, and I was always scribbling things down. I was very alive to sound and to rhythm, but I didn't understand that until much, much later. It was really only when I entered the writer's studio in this mentorship relationship with Wade, interesting enough, that I really started to get a consciousness of looking back on my scribbles and my little jottings and... you know, really being drawn to rhyme and refrains and all that. It was happening, but I didn't understand that it was happening.
So you are trained as a lawyer, educated as a lawyer. What made you go into writing?
I think writing has always been something I do like breathing. And, you know, again, the sort of immigrant background, you know, you're going to be a writer instead of a lawyer? How will that play? But it's very interesting, again, going back to Wade's tutelage, you know, trying to look at language. What you'll find in my poetry that I'm beginning to realize is I'm always riffing on my background as a lawyer. And Wade introduced me to other poets in Canada, funnily enough. There's this connection between lawyering and being a poet. There's this very fine poet, Marlene Norbizi Phillip, that Wade introduced me to, and she's a lawyer. And an African-Canadian and a fantastic poet. and is cited in my work because I really found her like she became a wayfinder for me. So this idea of different languages mm-hmm. and different ways of representing language and playing around with it, messing it up. Mm-hmm. This is how I experience poetry, you know.
And so going from your past to where you are today as a writer and now as an instructor and as a mentor to writers, does that add anything to say, the context of one's life? Do you understand life a little bit better because you've taken the time to write?
Oh, I would hope so.
Yeah.
I mean, on my good days. And also, Wade and I talk about this, learning with students. I feel that my understanding of what it means to write in this time, in this place, is immeasurably deepened by this opportunity to learn and be a mentor instructor in a place of learning. I just can't get enough of it, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's some. Yeah, I think there's something really instructive about teaching, right?
Yeah.
In that you. Having that responsibility for what you do, and then listening to someone else's work and responding to it, is different from just reading work, because you know when you respond to it, you have to have reasons for why you're responding to it. Just the workshop model itself is very much like that for anyone involved in it. Is that it no longer allows you to just follow your tastes or whims, right? You have to actually, you know, defend what you're saying when you're responding to something, and you have a responsibility for being heard by the person who wrote it. And just doing that, I think, really makes you consider very carefully what writing is and how it works and what it is to receive something. And yeah.
So teaching has made your writing better, if you will?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I don't think I would have written fiction if I hadn't been teaching narrative, right? Mm. I mean, teaching narrative with people really kind of opened up, you know, well, you know, reading it and responding to it made me sort of aware of how narrative worked. That's really what it was.
You know, it's one thing to have, as I read in the introduction, all these awards and all this acclaim that you've had as a writer. But it's another thing, because I've talked to a number of writers who have cited you, Renee among them, as pivotal in their careers. It kind of got me wondering as to who Wade Compton was back in the day. I mean, was there someone for you that?
Yeah, a bunch of people for different things, right? Different reasons. But George Bowring was really big as a mentor for me when I was at SFU, and Roy Meakey as well. But it was a whole scene of writers. You know, Jamie Reed, who recently passed away. Was in that scene. Renee Roden was in that scene as well, and George Stanley, and others who were people that, yeah, I had a weird 20s. Like in my mid 20s, I was hanging out with these old guys who were all like, you know, old guard poets and loving it. You know, that would be Friday night. It'd be like, you know, hang out with the old poets and then go and listen to drum and bass after or something like that. Right?
Yeah.
And I loved it. It was just fantastic. But for different reasons, I got different things from different people. With Roy Meakey, you know, really I credit Roy with keeping me in the English department at that time and in language at a time when I was inclined to go with history. And it was because Roy presented this model for, you know, looking at writers of color and writing as part of an anti-racism. You know, and so, yeah, it was huge for me. I took a particular class with Roy Meakey at SFU in the 90s, where I remember this is what decided me on staying with poetry.
And it must have been, I mean, gratifying may seem like the wrong word, but you know, we're surrounded by books here, and there are a number of books that have you in the acknowledgments and the sort. I mean, these are people that you've taught, people that you've known. I mean, it must be awfully rewarding.
Yeah, it is.
He can't get rid of us.
I wouldn't want to. No, it's great. I mean, and this all comes from Betsy Warland. That's the other person I should mention, too, is this idea of community. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just the community around SFU and TWS, the Writer Studio, is just such a wonderful thing. It's just so wonderful, you know, having all of these people who are along on this journey. It's a different model for thinking about you know, writing than the one that's kind of in the popular media of the kind of lone romantic figure sort of, you know, struggling and, you know, in their attic or something like that all by themselves, which is a myth, you know. It's like sharing your work with other people. And I always think, I mean, writing is like a guerrilla war. It's really this thing that you get done by any means, and it's just, it's always a struggle. It's always hard. George Orwell describes it as a long illness. Like, creating a book is like coming through a long illness. It's just incredibly difficult, always. And so having people around that recognize that and sort of, you know, cheer you along and want to see you succeed, that's, to me, what a writing community is, and I love having one.
Yeah. And I mean, you're doing all sorts of things now, I understand, and not just writing. You're both working for the stage now, if you will. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got Air India Redacted coming up in a couple of weeks.
I can't wait to see it. Yes.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. It's a pretty amazing thing. Yeah,
would you tell us about, because we've read about it online, but we might not, I mean, what are we to expect when we go there those nights?
Well, it is, I think, mostly an immersive experience. The book has been made into a libretto in collaboration with myself and the Irish composer Jürgen Simpson, who has a Scottish-German name, but he's born and brought up in Ireland. He's from Limerick. And we have a director, Tom Creed, from Dublin and Cork, and we have a visual media artist from Limerick. And so there'll be poetry, projections, visual images, three incredible Canadian singers, a soprano, a baritone, and a countertenor. And they will sing the music composed by Jürgen, directed by Owen Underhill of Canada's acclaimed Turning Point Ensemble, like just amazing musicians, many of whom work with poets in very interesting ways, like François Houle, who is the partner of Katrina Strang, is just a fabulous musician who will be part of the ensemble playing. So shout out to Turning Point Ensemble. And in conjunction with SFU Woodwards and Turning Point Ensemble, they're producing this Air India Redacted November 6th to 11th at SFU Woodward's Bay and Milton Wong Experimental Theater. It's the same stage as Lepage. You know, we don't have his budget, but it's going to be amazing. And so I think the thing that they can expect is an absolute sensory immersion into this world. And it is, it's not an opera, it's like staged musical poetry.
So what's that like? Because we talked about this book when it came out a couple of years ago, to now have it on stage like that. I mean, it must add something to the writing that you spent a lot of time with.
Yeah, I learn again. It's been an incredibly intense learning experience to see singers, directors, musicians, and a composer just get so close to the language in the book. And also, it's been absolutely terrifying during rehearsals where the director goes line by line and asks you, you know, well, why this and what's this and what's happening here? And it's been a very deep learning experience. You know, it really does make you conscious of language. And, an incredible journey. I have to pinch myself. You know, you don't know where the work's going to take you.
Yeah.
You just don't know, you know.
I mentioned The Outer Harbor, which was just shortlisted for the City of Vancouver Book Prize. That's gotten a lot of great attention, Wade, in terms of your skill as a writer. I mean, a lot of people online, I'm hearing about it. I have it in front of us here, but I haven't opened it yet. But what's that been like? Because this is your first work of fiction, to have it come out with such great notices and acclaim.
Yeah, it's been good. It's the best things that are coming back to me are the emails. So people individually getting in touch with me about how it's affected them or something specific. But what I like about a book of short stories is people focus on different stories. And so some people are saying, oh, this story really did this for me. Mm-hmm. And others are focusing on different ones. So, I like that. I think, listening to Renee talk about that, I think it's something, when you put a book out, it goes out there in the world, and then it belongs to other people. Mm-hmm. And they see it in ways you didn't expect them to, or find things in it that are surprises to you. So it feels almost like the process of writing, it carries on afterwards. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that's what you were describing there, and that feeling of seeing how other people are interacting with it and what they notice. That's what I that's the best part of this experience for me.
And the Revolving City, this collection of poems, this will have a life long after its publication, won't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we sure hope so. We would like, especially, I think, teachers of poetry to take a look at it. And I think at the college and senior levels, you know, 11, 12, grade 11, 12, and college universities, I think they'll find it really useful.
Yeah.
Hopefully, and then we'll hear from people. I just want to give a shout out to Wade as well, who's also writing a libretto, because I think it's kind of interesting we're both doing this.
Right, yeah. In the depths of that.
Well, what's that about, may I ask?
Well, James Douglas. So, yeah. It was a figure I've written about before, but the composer is Obadiah Jones, and we're writing something about his life, the life of. Of Sir James Douglas.
Yeah, he's someone that we need to know more about. Mm-hmm. I mean, we know about Amor de Cosmos a bit, but no one else from that era, and such a significant figure in this province's history.
Yeah, he's a very interesting person and very full of ambivalences.
Yeah, and of just a fascinating background.
Mm-hmm.
I can't wait for that. It's been such a delight, because I remember with great fondness the interview that we had a couple of years ago for your book, Renee, for you to come in to do this. I really appreciate it.
My great pleasure.
And Wade, your reputation precedes you, so to have you come in today, it's been a great pleasure for me.
Great, thanks for having us.
The book is called The Revolving City, 51 poems, and the stories behind them. It's from Anvil Press. Visit their websites. Renee's is at thecanadaproject@wordpress.com and wadecompton.com. Wade Compton and Renee Sacklicard join me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.